Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you'll hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star, then zero on your touchtone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Johnny Nazarian, Education Program Manager at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Thank you so much, Bella. As mentioned, my name is Johnny Nazarian. My pronouns are they, them, and I'm the Education Program Manager here at Cancer Care. And I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect Education Workshop titled Understanding the Role of Immunotherapy in Treating Cancer. This activity is supported by a grant from Genentech, and I really want to thank them for the support of today's program. Now, just to start, I want to let you know how many people we have on the call today. We have over 200 participants on the call, primarily from the United States, from rural, urban, suburban, and frontier communities. We also have a number of international participants from Australia, Canada, and the Philippines. So it is a global call. We are delighted to have you all on this program today and that you've chosen to spend this next hour with us. And now I'm going to introduce our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Mark Criss. And Dr. Criss is William and Joy Lane Chair in Thoracic Oncology, Attending Physician, Thoracic Oncology Service, Department of Medicine, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, Professor of Medicine, Weill Cornell Medical College. And Dr. Criss will be discussing an overview of immunotherapy, harnessing the immune system, and treating cancer, including cancer vaccines, as well as follow-up care. It is now my great pleasure to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Criss.
Thank you, and thank you all for joining today. I feel sort of privileged to be able to talk about immunotherapy. In that it has been a dream of the community that has treated persons with cancer for well over 100 years. And in truth, we have never had medications that would help a large proportion of people with cancer. But in the last decade, that has changed. You know, despite 90 years of rough going, we finally have found a group of medicines that really make a difference in people's lives, both in lengthening their time free of cancer and curing cancers, even when they have spread. So we're very excited about the role of immunotherapy and making sure that it's available to every person with cancer that could benefit from it. A couple words about the immune system. I know it may have been a long time since many of you have studied biology, and frankly, whatever many of us learned in elementary and high school and even college is pretty out of date now. But suffice it to say that our immune system is perhaps absolutely the most amazing part of human anatomy. We are constantly being bombarded by infectious agents that could easily take over and end our lives. But our immune system is working 24/7 to keep that from happening. Also, there are many cells that go awry that could become cancerous, and our immune system just takes care of those as well. So how does it do it? We have cells in our body that do two things. They're the so-called B cells, and these B cells, when they sense an attacker, they can make proteins, antibodies, that specifically go after aspects of that attacker. Vaccines are the best example for infectious diseases, and I'll talk about that in a second. The second arm of our immune system is so-called T cells. Now, these cells attack any kind of invader, particularly viruses, cancer cells, and some bacteria by a cellular mechanism, not a protein, but a cell actually finds the attacker and destroy it. These T cells are assisted by many, many other cells we have in our body, the monocytes, macrophages, dendritic cells. You may have heard all these names, killer cells. All of these things are part of our cellular immune system. And together, these cells protect us 24/7. We also have cells, white blood cells, that particularly deal with infection and inflammation. I'm not going to get into those today. So I think the one important aspect I do want to say a word on is the importance of vaccines for a person's fighting cancer. There are, I'll call them the big five vaccines. There are three for respiratory viruses, RSV, influenza, and COVID-19, and another virus vaccine of the affecting the skin, and primarily that is the vaccine for herpes zosters or shingles, and lastly the pneumonia vaccines. And with very, very rare exception, everybody should have all five of these vaccines, and everyone should have the latest version of these vaccines, because certain viruses like the flu and COVID keep changing, and each year newer versions of the vaccine are prepared, and those fight the specific version of the virus that is likely to attack. Now, a lot of this is done by estimation, and it's not perfect, but I think the bottom line is when you take a vaccine, though it may not perfectly protect, it protects some, and protects some people as opposed to others, and it's definitely worthwhile to do it. And I would just say that the benefit far outweighs the risk. Back in the day, there were some contraindication, there were eggs, some people allergic to the vaccine, and there are ways around that. For example, there are vaccines that can be given orally or intranasally that don't have any eggs. So even if you have an egg protein allergy, you can still have it. I urge you to talk to your physicians about this and make sure you get all the vaccines. And, you know, we're going to have a new flu season and COVID season coming up starting in the fall. New vaccines should be available. Please get those vaccines as soon as you can. The other thing I push on my colleagues and patients is to use, I'll call them the extra drugs that help if you have one of the viral diseases, a drug called Tamiflu that is used if you have influenza, a drug called Paxlovid used if you have COVID. Again, these drugs aren't perfect, but they do give you a little bit of an edge, and you need this edge as your body is also fighting cancer, and you need to make sure these infectious organisms are taken care of. So let's talk now more specifically about the harnessing the immune system in fighting cancer. And I'm going to specifically talk about lung cancer. That's the field I know. I think other speakers today may talk about how the immune system can be hardest for lymphoma, for melanoma, but I'm going to talk specifically about lung cancer. You heard me mention already that our B cells make antibodies. And these antibodies, the way we know them best is say that you're exposed to influenza. Your body makes antibodies against that influenza virus that deactivate it. But these antibodies can also be created now in the laboratory and used as a medication to treat specific cancers. In lung cancer, there's a drug called cetuximab, a drug called panitumumab. These drugs attack EGFR, the EGFR receptor, not the EGFR mutation, not the EGFR genes. And these drugs have been around. But this is the use of an antibody to specifically fight a cancer. The other use of the antibodies has been with the drugs that attack the substances that allow cancer blood vessels to form, drugs called such as bevacizumab or ramucirumab. These drugs, they're drugs that specifically attack proteins that help the cancer cell develop a blood stream a blood supply so it can grow and spread. There's a new class of drugs that use these antibodies to find the cancer cell. The antibody finds the cancer cell and has attached to it chemotherapies. The drug called datopotamab, Dato-DXd, for example, T-DXd, these drugs have entered the clinic and are available now to combine an antibody technology with a chemotherapy, antibody drug conjugates, they're called. The biggest change, though, is the use of the drugs that are so-called T-cell checkpoint inhibitors. So the body turns the immune system on and off. And what happens is cancer cells find a way to co-opt those same processes. And cancer cells have the capability of turning off the ability of the immune system to fight them, to eradicate them. And what these drugs do, these antibodies, they block the effect of the cancer cell in turning off your own immune system. So unlike a chemotherapy that kills cancer cells, these drugs allow your immune system to develop a reaction to the cancer cells. And there's two broad classes of these drugs. One is the drugs that attack PD-L1, atezolizumab, cemiplimab, durvalumab, nivolumab, pembrolizumab, and also the antibodies that go after the CTLA-4, the ipilimumab and the tremelimumab. They'll be talking later in melanoma about how these drugs are used. These drugs have become a standard. Every patient with small cell lung cancer gets these medicines, and nearly two-thirds of patients with non-small cell lung cancers get these medicines. So this has really, in just the last decade, become a standard of therapy. These drugs have the ability to lengthen the time you're free of cancer. They have the ability to shrink cancer, and very importantly, they also have the ability to cure patients even with advanced disease. It's just an amazing observation that cure can happen. So getting these drugs into your treatment program is extremely important. We've also found that these drugs can be used with chemotherapy and in certain situations have an even better result. And because these drugs are so effective, we're now giving them with after radiation, before and after surgery, and they not only can, again, lengthen the time cancer-free, but also lead to more cures. So at this point, harnessing the immune system has become a foundational way to fight cancer. At least in the lung cancer field, 80%+ of people receive these drugs and have the potential to derive benefit. We'll be talking later today about how we found ways to deal with the side effects of the drugs. Of course, every drug we give can lead to side effects, but our colleagues in dermatology, gastroenterology, and other specialties have taught us how to lessen these side effects if they can occur. In many ways, they can provide antidotes to the side effects of the immunotherapies, and they've made them safer and more available to patients. So I leave you today saying that the ability of drugs to harness the immune system to fight cancer has occurred. The drugs are in every pharmacy around the world. They continue to be improved. We continue to discover new ways to use them, more kinds of cancer, more situations where we're fighting cancer, for example, around surgery before and after, and these things are very important. We have other therapies in the pipeline, vaccines against cancer, cellular therapies, taking cells, teaching them how to fight cancer and putting them back in the body. These are works in progress, but these other treatments are here today. And I urge you to make sure you talk to your doctor and your healthcare team about making sure that if these drugs can help you, that you get them. And generally, you get them as soon as possible in your cancer journey. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Thank you very much, Dr. Chris. Okay, and our next speaker is Dr. Gregory Daniels, and Dr. Daniels is professor of medicine at UC San Diego Morris Cancer Center. And Dr. Daniels will be discussing clinical trial updates, how research contributes to your treatment options, as well as examples of immunotherapy and prevention, treatment, and recurrence prevention of cancer. It is now my great pleasure to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Daniels.
Great. Thank you very much, and thank you, Cancer Care, for putting on these symposia. I think they're very helpful to get out just some really foundational information that sometimes we don't get access to. And so my task is to talk about how research contributes to some of our treatments. And so as Dr. Chris, who specializes in lung cancer, I personally specialize in melanoma, so some of my examples will be coming from that. But I do want to just speak more broadly for a minute. So how do we know things work? I'm in clinic today, and I got bombarded with a bunch of questions. You know, can my dad tolerate this therapy? How long should I take immune therapy? Hey, I hear biopsies spread cancer. Do you really need to get a biopsy? So there's lots of questions, and how do we answer those questions, and what is the foundation for our medicine these days? In the last approximately 100 years, as Dr. Chris mentioned, we've been working on it with the idea that there's something in the background in the body. And one of those things that we've identified is the immune system. And early on, we knew something else was going on just because, for example, Dr. Cooley, who was a surgeon and pathologist in New York, went ahead and injected tumors with his Cooley's toxin, or so it was termed, which was a collection of bacteria. So he was purposefully infecting tumors with a bacteria. He did that because he had made some observations that patients whose wounds got infected seemed to have their tumors regress. And so he purposely was taking that observation and turning it into kind of a little mini clinical trial, and he presented a bunch of patients that he purposely infected. And over the years, he kept doing iterations of what eventually became known as Cooley's toxin. Ultimately, that story ended with a failed clinical trial that put a damper on that kind of intratumoral injections for many years, only to be reborn again once the science was rediscovered in terms of what the toxin was probably doing was just alerting the body to danger signals. And the body recognizes these patterns. And so a bunch of basic science rediscovered the idea of Cooley's toxin. And now they're commonly used, not the bacteria that Cooley was using, but the ideas in some of our vaccine strategies. And so observation, basic science, but ultimately we need to translate this into our clinical practice. And that's where clinical trials come in. Sometimes another thing I commonly hear in clinic is, oh, doc, is it that bad that you're talking to me about clinical trials? And, you know, it is always a hard conversation to have, but I look at clinical trials as, oh, no, it's not that bad. There's hope because we have all these great ideas and new things are being developed constantly, and here's some ideas that I want to discuss with you and how we're testing them. And so clinical trials are offered at academic centers. They're offered also in the community and they're considered standard practice in oncology. Early studies, you'll hear phase one, an early study. Those are studies where we're looking at the safety, dosing, and maybe some early activity signals from agents. There, you know, a common concern is, I don't want to be a guinea pig. Please don't give me a placebo. Often these studies, there are no placebos in early studies. We're giving everybody a defined dose of something that we've informed them about, and we're looking at the observations. Then come phase two studies where we've determined, we believe, the safety of an agent, but we want to check it in a few more patients and we'll define the activity. And then phase three studies are, we take what we've considered to be a new opportunity and compare it to what we normally do. And so a lot of times these larger phase three studies are looking at what we would standardly do versus some experimental agent where we think we've proven that we understand the safety and we just want to compare it to, in a real world setting as much as possible, how these agents perform. And so clinical trials are kind of the foundation where I can tell patients, yes, you know, you kind of fit the profile of a patient on this particular clinical trial, and here, X percent of patients experience this, and Y percent of the patients experience that, and I have some sort of basis in order to have that discussion. Versus, oh yeah, there was this guy in New York that used to inject people with bacteria, and some people got better. I have no idea what was going on or how many people got better or if this would even work for you, but, you know, it's something that's out there. And so clinical trials provide us with that information. It's just frustrating sometimes because clinical trials don't fit everybody, and clinical trials can't answer every question out there. I will also mention that clinical trials are very highly supervised. So as people are aware, there's the FDA, which approves medications, but what they're looking at in their approval is a batch of data that they can rely on. That generally comes from clinical trials where patients are, as I mentioned, put through early and late phase studies and the data is assembled, but during that time, you have institutional review boards, these are called IRBs, made up by the community, experts in the field, statisticians, as well as ongoing monitoring by both the investigators and the people sponsoring the studies. So this is a pretty robust process that's gotten us to this point. Well, what point is that? Well, today we're talking about immune therapies. As Dr. Chris says, there are these checkpoint inhibitors. The last 20 to 15 years, they've entered clinical practice through clinical trials and have dramatically changed our options that we can offer patients. So before, we were limited to surgery, radiation, and chemo. Now we have a fourth pillar that we call immune therapy. And for a variety of tumors, it's not only changed the outcomes, but changed our general practice. For example, in another type of skin cancer called squamous cell cancer of the skin, advanced tumors, which often happen in sun-exposed areas, we would commonly do large surgeries. They might hurt somebody. With the surgery, we might have to do radiation, but recent clinical trials have shown that as limited as a month or two exposure to a checkpoint inhibitor can sometimes obviate the need for radiation. So patients normally would have gotten radiation, they don't need it. Or we've even seen patients have complete responses where they don't need surgeries anymore, which is a huge change in the field for cutaneous squamous cell. And that's spread over to colon cancers and lung cancers and other ones. Just briefly, I'm tasked with talking about prevention and treatments. I've just kind of mentioned a little bit of the treatment. Prevention is, you know, after a cancer occurs, we want to prevent it from coming back. Again, historically, we've talked about radiation and chemo after a surgery, but nowadays, for many cancers, we consider adjuncts like immune therapies. Again, clinical trials have shown that in multiple tumor types that giving immune therapies after surgery can lower the risk of the tumor coming back. And more recently, we started giving immune therapies before surgery. This is called neoadjuvant treatment. And not only does it lower the risk of it coming back, but it gives us some information right away that can tailor treatments for the patient going forward. Lastly, I'll just mention, you know, how do you prevent cancer? How do you prevent recurrences? How do you prevent cancers? And when I think about the immune system, going back to, we always knew there was something in the background. Well, immune therapy isn't just medications. Immune therapy is exercise. Immune therapy is proper diet. Immune therapy is getting good rest, not smoking, having a healthy weight. All these things influence the immune system. So there are even clinical trials looking at prescribed or describing the amount of exercise somebody has for, say, colon cancer, and looking at recurrence rates and overall survival, showing very dramatic improvements in outcomes by these type of what I call immune therapies, what other people call just healthy lifestyle. And we could measure some of these parameters in the blood and show that the immune system's in a better state with those type of interventions. Or with diet. There's a recent study out of MD Anderson where they prescribed diets of higher fiber to patients undergoing immune therapy and showed that this appeared to influence the response rate, outcomes, and toxicity profiles while patients were on therapy. So lots happening over the last 15 to 20 years brought on by the basic science rediscovery and the translation through clinical trials back into practice, and really an exciting time for getting new tools for cancer therapy. So with that, I'll stop mine.
Thank you very much, Dr. Daniels. And our next speaker is Dr. Alireza Ahmed Alu, and Dr. Alu is Medical Director, Division of Dermatology, NYU Langone Hospital, Long Island, Associate Professor of Dermatology, Department of Medicine, NYU Grossman Long Island School of Medicine. And Dr. Alu will be discussing reporting treatment side effects and discomfort to the healthcare team, as well as guidelines to prepare for telehealth/telemedicine appointments, including logistics, prepared list of questions, and discussion of open notes. It is now my great pleasure to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Alu.
Thanks, Johnny. First, I'd like to start by thanking Cancer Care for inviting me to participate in today's workshop. It's definitely a privilege to be a part of this this panel and to have the opportunity to speak, you know, with patients, caregivers, and families about topics that can have a significant impact on the cancer treatment experience. So as mentioned, my name is Alireza Alu, and my clinical practice focuses primarily on oncodermatology, which is basically the care of patients who develop skin, hair, nail, and mucosal side effects related to their cancer and cancer therapies, including immunotherapy. So I work closely with oncologists and other multidisciplinary cancer teams to help patients navigate treatment-related side effects and maintain their quality of life throughout their cancer journey. So, you know, through this and through many years of doing it, one of the most important lessons that I've learned is that effective communication between patients, their caregivers, and their healthcare team is essential. The earlier we understand what our patients are experiencing, the better we can help them navigate treatment safely and comfortably. So today I've been asked to discuss two topics. First is reporting treatment side effects and discomfort to your healthcare team. And second is how we can prepare for telehealth and telemedicine appointments, including how to use tools such as open notes and patient portals. So my hope is that by the end of this discussion, you'll feel a little bit more informed and empowered to communicate with your healthcare team, advocate for yourself or your loved ones, and make the most of the resources that are available to support your care. So, you know, to start with, you know, treatment-related side effects, I think one of the most important messages that I can share with you today is that you should never, ever hesitate to tell your healthcare team about any new symptoms or side effects from your cancer treatment. I think, you know, many patients obviously worry that reporting their symptoms may lead to treatment delays or that they're disturbing their providers. In reality, the exact opposite is true. The earlier we know about a problem, the more likely we can manage it effectively and keep you on track with your treatment. So I think this is super important for patients who are receiving immunotherapy. Unlike traditional chemotherapy, as has been mentioned by our panelists, immunotherapy works by activating your immune system to essentially recognize and attack cancer cells. Now, while you know that has led to a lot of amazing breakthroughs in the treatment of cancer, the activated immune system can also affect normal tissues and organs throughout the body. And side effects can involve almost any organ system, including the skin, the GI system, lungs, your endocrine glands, and the nervous system. And many of these side effects often can be very subtle to begin with, and in that regard may seem pretty insignificant. But if we don't recognize them or discuss them, they can become more serious later. So as an oncodermatologist, I care for patients who develop skin-related side effects from immunotherapy, and what may begin as mild itching or rash often can become more uncomfortable if not addressed early. And we're lucky that most of these skin side effects now can be managed successfully when identified and treated promptly. And more importantly, a lot of times we can keep patients on their cancer treatment. So I think the take home here is that my advice, you know, is very simple. When in doubt, you know, reach out and speak to your healthcare team. You don't have to worry about deciding whether a symptom is important enough to report. Anything that's new, whether it's a rash, whether it's diarrhea, shortness of breath, cough, headaches, vision changes, anything that feels different from your normal should be brought to the attention of your healthcare team. The other thing that's really helpful when you're reporting your symptoms is to provide as much context as possible. You know, tell your providers when the symptom started, whether it's improving or worsening, how severe it is, what have you tried to help with the symptom, and how it's affecting your daily life. For me personally, as a dermatologist, obviously photographs are very valuable. So taking some photographs over a period of time can sometimes help assess the problem a little bit more accurately, because these things can change. You know, I often see patients who, you know, will show me a picture of their rash when it started, and when they're seen, it kind of looks different. So again, being able to chronicle that over time is helpful. I think, again, the take home here is that your healthcare team wants to hear from you. And early communication definitely improves safety. It helps maintain quality of life. It reduces the risk of serious complications, and it allows your treatment to continue more effectively. So moving on to telehealth appointments, what I want you to take away is how you can make the most of these virtual visits. Telemedicine is an incredibly important part of healthcare and cancer care specifically. It allows our patients to remain connected to their teams while reducing travel time. It increases convenience. And it's a great option for patients who are obviously undergoing active treatment and are spending a lot of time traveling back and forth between their homes and the hospital. As it relates to, you know, the appointments, preparation before the appointment can make your visit far more productive. You know, simple things before your appointment, make sure your device is charged, that you have a good internet connection. Make sure you know how to access the visit. Log in a few minutes early and address any technical issues that you may have. You know, obviously choose a quiet, well-lit location where you can focus on the discussion without any distractions. And as I mentioned, if your visit involves a skin concern, good lighting is important. But as I mentioned, having some photographs available that we can evaluate during your treatment is also helpful. I also encourage patients to really prepare a list of written questions beforehand, because, you know, these appointments can be short, but they obviously, there's a lot of information that's exchanged. So it's very common to leave an appointment and then suddenly remember something that you wanted to ask. So, you know, while these appointments, you know, can be quick, it's important to have a list of at least two or three questions that are very, very important to you that you want to get across, and have them available during the visit so that you can ask your providers. Additionally, it's always good to help, to have an updated list of medications, any vitamins or supplements that you may be taking, or any specific symptoms or concerns that you may have. The next thing I think is incredibly invaluable. If a caregiver or a family member is involved in your care, consider having them participate in the visit as well. A second set of ears is always incredibly helpful when you're discussing, you know, complex medical information. In terms of open notes, you know, it's an incredibly important development in modern healthcare. It allows patients to access their clinical notes, their laboratory results, and imaging reports through their respective portals. I think about it as an incredible advancement. It promotes transparency. It encourages patients to become, you know, active participants in their care. It allows you to review information after your appointments. You can share updates with your family members, and it allows you to better understand your treatment. But I think at the same time, I encourage patients not to become overly focused on interpreting test results or imaging reports on their own. Laboratory findings, imaging findings are often complex and have to be interpreted within the broader context of a patient's medical history, their treatment, their symptoms, and other test results. So sometimes a test result that appears abnormal may not be significant, while a result that appears reassuring may still require some discussion with your healthcare team. In the same way, radiology reports often can contain a lot of medical terminology that can sound alarming when read without an appropriate context. So it's important to remember that these reports are written as a communication between medical professionals and may not fully reflect your overall picture as a patient. So, you know, my advice is to use open notes and patient portals as a tool to stay informed and engaged, but not as a substitute for conversations with your providers. Review your information before your appointments, write down any questions that you may have, and then, you know, certainly discuss them with your healthcare team so that they can help you interpret them with the right context. Again, you know, telemedicine and open notes are designed to strengthen communication, improve access to care, and help patients become more active participants in their treatment journey.
Great. Thank you very much, Dr. Alu. And our next speaker is Ms. Melissa Cyrus. And Ms. Cyrus is an oncology social worker as well as Long Island program manager here at Cancer Care. And Ms. Cyrus will be discussing Cancer Care's free national programs and services, as well as how to get in contact with us through our Hope Line and website. It is now my great pleasure to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Ms. Cyrus.
Thanks, Joni, for the introduction. It's a privilege to be part of this knowledgeable panel and speak to you today about Cancer Care Services. Cancer Care is a national leading nonprofit organization providing free professional support services and information to help people manage the emotional, practical, and financial challenges of cancer. Our comprehensive services include resource navigation, counseling and support groups, educational workshops, publications, and limited financial assistance. To become connected to any of Cancer Care services, those interested can call Cancer Care's National Hope Line to speak to an oncology social worker at 1-800-813-4673. And there are many aspects of a cancer diagnosis that may be addressed throughout psychosocial supportive services, making informed treatment decisions, quality of life concerns, clinical trials, fertility options, and communication with one's medical team are important topics that can be discussed with an oncology social worker. I'd also like to highlight one of Cancer Care's programs, our resource navigation services. Cancer Care's resource navigation services are offered nationally to patients, post-treatment survivors, and caregivers affected by cancer. We offer a short-term, strength-based approach to resource navigation, where the resource navigators will work with the client in connecting them to resources, referrals, and financial assistance. Whether you need practical, financial, or emotional support, our navigators can help provide you with resources to meet your needs. On Cancer Care's website, cancercare.org, there's also a wide array of reading materials that are informative on different treatment options. This includes recorded Connect education workshops, Cancer Out Loud, the Cancer Care podcast, publications about coping with your diagnosis, as well as stories of help and hope, among many other resources. I hope the information provided is helpful, and I will pass it back to our host.
Thank you very much, Ms. Cyrus. And now we're going to move on to the Q&A. We're going to take as many of your questions as possible. I'm going to ask Bella to explain to you how to queue up for questions.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, we will take questions from the web only. You may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question.
All right. And our first question here is for Dr. Daniels. You mentioned clinical trials and how people can be reticent to enroll. Why does it take so long to qualify for a trial, especially for patients progressing on their present regimen?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. There's a lot of barriers to getting on a clinical trial, and one of them is the time it takes to get on. And sometimes it's not offered at the place that you're getting treated, and so you have to go to another treatment center, be evaluated. With clinical trials, they're trying to really define the benefit of a therapy in as regulated a way as possible. And so there are certain requirements for what was your last treatment, when was your last treatment, do we have all the scans? If there's any particular toxicity they're worried about, maybe we need to get some extra tests, like pulmonary function tests or things like that. So it is a huge burden sometimes, depending on the trial, to go through the eligibility for getting on a trial. And honestly, it takes minimally probably 2 to 4 weeks to get onto a clinical trial, even when things are clicking right. So if cancers are progressing quickly, it's probably not the right thing to get onto a trial. If cancers are, though, slow, then there's a window, or if it's a prevention trial. I will say that having these discussions early so that you can think about how to coordinate trial participation into your care plan is important, because then you can time certain evaluations that overlap with that.
Great. Thank you very much, Dr. Daniels. And I have a question here for Dr. Alou. I'm starting immunotherapy for breast cancer, and I was told about a rash developing as a potential side effect. If I do develop a rash, should I tell my team right away? And can it be treated with over-the-counter medication?
That's a great question. So you know, the skin is probably the most common site of toxicity to immunotherapies, and it's important to know that it can actually occur at any point during your treatment. So with that in mind, most certainly, as we discussed, you know, any of the side effects that you get, it's important to let your treatment team know. And as mentioned, you know, if we can identify it early, we certainly can give you a plan that should hopefully prevent it from progressing. So again, I would say there definitely are ways to help manage such side effects when they occur. And the sooner that we're informed, the easier it is going to be to treat and to continue and to maintain the anti-cancer treatment.
Thank you very much, Dr. Alou. I have a question here for Dr. Daniels. What are the next steps if my cancer becomes resistant to my targeted immunotherapy?
Yeah, so understanding resistance has been a real active area. So for some immune therapies, we have kind of some strategies. For example, in melanoma, if people are resistant to what's called PD-1, a drug like pembrolizumab, otherwise known as Keytruda, or one of these checkpoints, that then going on to a different immune therapy, such as adoptive T-cell therapy, or TILs, can overcome that resistance. But for many cancers, we don't have it defined yet. What is the way to overcome that resistance? So active area of clinical trials and research, and again, my plug is to talk to your treating physician and you know, have an early discussion about the appropriateness of clinical trials answering that.
Thank you very much, Dr. Daniels. We actually have another question here for you. Melanoma has historically been considered a very serious cancer, but I hear there are melanomas which respond well to immunotherapy. Can you comment on this issue?
Yeah, as I mentioned in my talk, the last 15, 20 years has really been we'll use that colloquial term, sea change, for melanoma management. Advanced melanomas, those that have spread, used to have a very poor outcome. Unfortunately, poor outcomes still happen, but for many patients, the current immune therapies can control the disease. I'm in clinic. I just spoke with a patient today who had metastatic melanoma, had immune therapy, and we just decided today to stop treatment because all her cancer's gone on scans for the last 6 months, and she feels well, and we're just going to observe her. But things like that really didn't happen before, but are happening more and more, again, kind of through the clinical trial pipeline that helped support this change.
Thank you very much, Dr. Daniels. And actually, Ms. Cyrus, I have a question here for you. Where would you direct patients to find resources/information about immunotherapy or specific to certain cancer diagnoses? Examples, I was recently diagnosed with liver cancer. Immunotherapy is a potential option, and would like to learn more about options specific to liver cancer without getting overwhelmed by doing just a Google search and not knowing what's a reliable source and what isn't.
So I would encourage individuals to give us a call on our Hope Line, that number that I mentioned before. We do have resources we do share. We have a resource database, so if there's something specific we can share on that call, we'd be happy to help with directing to, like, you know, credible sources of information or ones that can best answer any specific questions you may have. But we also do have a resource navigation service that really can take the time to go more into detail about specific resources. So that would be meeting with our resource navigators and being able to discuss some of those needs and locating resources for you to follow up with. So I would just encourage just to call our Hope Line, speak to our Hope Line specialists, and see how we can help with identifying resources.
Thank you very much, Ms. Cyrus, and thank you to the participant for asking that question. One question here. For Dr. Daniels, why do I feel worse while on immunotherapy treatment?
Yeah, and I know Dr. Chris can answer this too, but we'll take a stab. So immune therapy uses your normal immune system and allows it to go in and kill the cancer. But that immune system is also interacting with your skin, your colon, other organs. And so when we give a checkpoint, we're removing a natural regulator of the immune system. And some people can get fevers, some people get rashes, fatigue, loose stools. There's a laundry list of things that can happen. Now, they vary based on the tumor type. They vary based on the immune therapies. You know, I'm focusing on the checkpoints. There are cytokines that are used. There's cell therapies that are used, vaccines. And everything has a risk associated with it. But certainly, I would say that these risks, we understand them pretty well, again, through clinical trials, and that's why you get routine blood tests with it. Your doctor's watching your hormone levels. And for some things, it's supportive care, and other things, we have to step in and try to fix stuff. But it's, what you're experiencing is, unfortunately, is common.
Thank you, Dr. Daniels. And now I'm going to ask our speakers to provide their takeaways for today. We'll start with Dr. Daniels, then Dr. Alou, and then Ms. Cyrus. So, Dr. Daniel, your takeaway?
Yeah, my takeaway is to engage in discussions with your care team, use your resources, bring up questions, and consider if clinical trials are an option for you and if it feels sort of like the right option for you. In practice, only about 5 to 10% of oncology patients end up participating in clinical trials. And I think if we increase that percentage up, then our knowledge would grow faster and our options would improve. So I always do encourage people to consider participating in clinical trials.
Thank you very much, Dr. Daniels and Dr. Alou.
So, you know, I'd like to conclude basically saying that, you know, I think the one central theme that connects at least both of my topics is communication. So whether you're reporting a new symptom, you know, sharing a photograph of a rash or preparing questions before your telehealth visit, you know, effective communication is one of the most powerful ways to improve your care. And as I tell, you know, I tell all my patients, you're the expert on your own experience. So your observations, your concerns, and your questions provide important information that helps your healthcare team make the best decision possible. So I really, you know, encourage you all to speak up, ask questions, report your symptoms early, and remain actively engaged in your care. And I think by working together as partners, we can help ensure the safest, most effective, and most supportive treatment experience possible.
Thank you very much, Dr. Alou and Ms. Cyrus.
I'd like to just highlight, you know, that while immunotherapy is changing the way cancer is treated, successful care requires more than this, managing the disease itself. Addressing the emotional, social, financial, and caregiver impacts of treatment is essential, and oncology social workers can play a key role in helping patients and families navigate these challenges through the cancer journey. I would encourage, if there is a social worker at your treatment center, just to utilize them in addition to your, you know, medical team with your treatment providers, nurses. A social worker can really help bridge some of those gaps there. And, you know, though advances in cancer treatment improve outcomes, patients' psychosocial needs remain just as important. Whole person care is critical to maximizing quality of life and treatment success.
Thank you very much, Ms. Cyrus. And now I just want to take a moment to thank all of our speakers. We had an absolutely phenomenal panel today with incredibly informative presentations. And I also want to thank our participants. Thank you for staying on and for joining us for this past hour. Today's program was particularly exceptional because of the questions that were asked and the way that our speakers addressed those questions. Now, I do want to say a few words, though, for those of you that didn't have your question answered, if you were typing your question, or even if you did have your question answered, please go back to your treating healthcare team and ask them your questions. Remember that you learned a great deal from today's program. Please take what you've learned and go back to your treating healthcare team and ask them your questions again and again. And one more thing is that I just want to mention. but I don't want anyone to leave this workshop feeling as if they are alone, because you are not alone. You have a community of support here at Cancer Care. Please know that we are here for you. Again, I want to thank everyone for their participation today. I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all so much.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone, have a great day.